evening. I've been teaching a study, this class segment, on what we've termed discipleship. One of the things we did in that was to actually go through a chart series that I have been using in trying to follow up some of the context that we have. And that's basically what we'll be doing in this Monday night study. I've not really decided whether we'll have it for 4 weeks, 5 weeks, maybe even just three, but basically I'll just be going through that chart material, explaining it. And I would say, especially if you're interested in helping follow up some of the contacts that we do generate, that this may very well be helpful to you. I think it would be helpful nevertheless. And if you're interested in that, you're certainly welcome to come. And I might just ask that if possible and you're interested in coming, that maybe we'll put a sheet of paper here at the back that you could sign your name to. Don't feel like that's committing you to it, but that's just so I can get some idea of how much material to copy in order to hand out. Usually the way that goes is if I make 30 copies, there are 5 people there. If I make about 10, we get about 40. So I want to get some idea of about how many to expect, and that will be very helpful. In Acts 8, verse 39, we're told about an Ethiopian eunuch who, after having been converted, goes on his way rejoicing. Have you ever seen someone baptized and do that very kind of thing? Someone who was full of joy? Usually that comes as a result of someone who probably hasn't had some kind of a background in the church. That's not to suggest that others are unhappy. But it seems especially that those who appreciate the gospel are those who have had very little contact with it. We've heard stories like that from various evangelists who have gone to Eastern Europe where many people have never had opportunity to obey the gospel. And yet, how many times does that joy seem to fade or dissipate, maybe after weeks or several months? And when it comes down to the commitment involved in attending services or doing Bible studies or problems arise at home, why, that initial enthusiasm seems to fade. I know a young man in London, England, Clive Wilson, about 8 or 9 years ago, approximately, at age of 16 years old, he learned the gospel. He was converted. Brother Whit Sasser, who's worked with this congregation, was instrumental in teaching and baptizing him. And initially he wasn't very interested. Then he got very zealous, was involved in a number of different efforts, and then he fell away. And in my last opportunity to go and talk with him about his indifference toward the gospel, he told me that he knew that at one time he had been 100% as far as his service toward God was concerned. And that he knew at that point in time that I was talking to him, he didn't really feel that way, and therefore there was no point going back and trying to be of service until he was at that 100% mark. And we probably heard people make the same kind of comment. Someone who says, well, you know, I really don't feel so much like coming and worshiping with the saints, and so I'd almost be doing the Lord a disservice if I was to come and almost pretend that I wanted to be there when maybe in my own heart I don't want to. And on the surface, that sounds like a good argument. But what that's saying, in connection with the other example, is that maybe that joy, that feeling is not there, and so should there be any commitment on our part? Now let me add one third example or illustration to this list of things. I think that there are churches today who are trying to appeal to people on the basis of getting them involved and interested by activities that they are going to enjoy. Several weeks ago, Brother Sewell Hall, I think at the start of the year, had a lesson concerning, started out by talking about junk mail and leaflets that he would get about church growth and some of the appeals that churches are making. And I made some similar illustrations in my lesson that night, and Brother Martin Broadwell had brought a little leaflet that he had received from a church near to him. And I got to looking at that, and you know, sometimes preachers sort of overstate the case. They exaggerate a little bit. But I just want to share with you some of the programs being offered by this particular denominational group. If you'll just look at this list, I don't know that you can see the fine print, But you'll notice that in their Family Life Center, they were having classes on social dance for beginners, LZ aerobics, I'm not sure what that is, LZ evening aerobics, PACE, people with arthritis can exercise, is what that stands for, walk and runners, racquetball, games men and boys play. That's not the end of the list there. Cooking classes for men of all ages. You wives would be probably happy to have your husbands take part in that. Wood carving, stained glass, knitting, neighborhood music school, window treatments. And then the list concludes here with what is a PC if you're trying to find out how to run a computer, basic estate planning, making your money work for you, what's controlling your life recovery classes, adult, infant, and child CPR. You know, those would be wonderful lists if we're talking about the neighborhood health club or if we're talking about the agenda for DeKalb Community College. But that's a church that's offering that as a part of their program. Now, apart from whether or not those things are wrong and right, and I believe that the church has no right to provide such services, I want to suggest to you that the outreach of that particular church seems to be get people involved in something that they want to do and enjoy doing. And I would not doubt that the end result that they're hoping for is not just to get them involved in those programs, but as a result of that, get them involved in spiritual interests. And indeed, a lot of people maybe go about religion in that way. Now, what I want to raise as a question is, what is the relationship between the joy that we are to experience as Christians and the commitment that we have toward Christ? It seems that many would feel that if there is not that joy, there maybe should be no commitment. Or until there is that joy, there can be no commitment. Or by creating joy, then we're going to create commitment. And I want to go to the book of Philippians this morning to answer that question as to what the relationship is between these two. If you have a Bible, you might turn to this short letter that Paul writes to the Philippian church, only four chapters. And I want you to notice, all of our verses will be from this epistle this morning, that this is an epistle, first of all, that is filled with joy on the part of Paul. You cannot read the book of Philippians without being impressed at what Paul says about rejoicing and being joyful. And surely that's something all of us would like to share in as far as being a Christian. Notice, for instance, in the way of references, we have in chapter 1 and verse 4, Paul making request in prayer. He says, with joy. He's joyful in his prayer. In chapter 1 and verse 18, he rejoices that the gospel is being preached. Over in chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, he says, I rejoice with you, brethren, as far as the gospel is concerned. And then later on in chapter 4 and verse 10, Paul says, I rejoice because you have responded to my needs and you have met those needs. Earlier in that chapter in verse 1, he refers to the Philippians as his joy and crown. Those brethren are his joy, he says. And then maybe encompassing all of these, in chapter 4 and verse 4, he says, rejoice in the Lord, and again I will say rejoice. We can't read this epistle without being impressed with the fact that Paul, as a Christian, is one who rejoices as far as the Lord is concerned. And then let me suggest that there is also a commitment on his part. Now, we might look at that and think from the listing there that Paul is in a very good arrangement, that things are going very well for him. And of course, if you studied the background of this epistle, it's termed one of the prison epistles. We know that that's just not the case. That Paul is writing from a circumstance of great want, great poverty. In fact, he is probably in prison in the city of Rome. If you remember in the book of Acts, when Paul goes back to Jerusalem in chapter 21, he's almost put to death there. In a mob scene in the area surrounding the temple, he is arrested by the Roman authorities. He is then put on trial before the Sanhedrin. And then when it's found that there is a plot to assassinate him, He's taken to the city of Caesarea, and three different times Paul has to make an appeal for his life before Felix, before Festus, before Agrippa. And the tragedy is that they don't even know what they're trying him for. They can't find a thing wrong with him. We might look at the recent court case of Mike Tyson and see all of the hoopla that surrounds that case. But that's nothing compared to what Paul had to go through. And this thing stretched out for some 5 years. Finally, Paul appeals to Caesar, and for that reason, he's taken to Rome and meets with shipwreck on the way. And there in Rome, he spends at least 2 years, it seems, waiting to find out whether or not he's going to be put to death. We sometimes see these documentaries about prison inmates on death row awaiting their outcome. That's exactly what Paul was doing. And yet it's from this very circumstance that he makes these comments. There is a commitment as far as Paul is concerned. Notice that he says, despite all of these things in chapter 4 and verse 13, notice the level of his commitment. He says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I would suggest that Paul had the key to knowing what the relationship between joy and commitment was. And I would like to look at the epistle from that standpoint and see if we can come to an understanding of what's involved as far as these two great principles. And I would suggest that the answer lies, as far as the Apostle Paul is concerned, with the fact that he was indeed committed to Christ. Look over at chapter 3 and verse 8. Paul, I think, reveals for us just why it was that serving the Lord was so important. Why, despite these adverse circumstances, he would keep on keeping on. He says in Philippians 3 and verse 8, but indeed I also count all things lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them as rubbish, that I may gain Christ. What a statement of dedication and loyalty on the part of Paul. Now, you know, sometimes we study the life of Christ, and we see his unwavering obedience. And yet maybe we think, well, you know, Christ was both human and divine. We have a hard time relating to him. We should have no problem relating to Paul. Yes, he was an apostle, but he was a man just as we are. He was a member of the human race. And yet the thing that keeps him going, he says, is his resolve to learn and be committed to the teaching of Christ. I think that involves at least a couple of things mentioned here in the text. First of all, there is a willingness on the part of Paul to sacrifice, to give up things that were important to him. Often we can know the level of our commitment by just how much we are willing to give up or sacrifice for something else. You know, when we talk about the past, when we reminisce about the past with somebody else, you know what we generally like to talk about? Usually we like to talk about, in the good old days, how tough things were and how tough they were for us. Have you ever done that with someone and just talked about some job you had or how difficult it was for you growing up? You know, we like to do that with our kids, don't we? We like to talk to them about trekking to school in the snow, foot of snow, walking a mile or so, try and impress upon them how difficult it was for us. And, you know, that happens from generation to generation. I'm sure if my kids grow up and they have children, they'll be telling their children that when they were young, they had to get up at 7:30 and have their mother take them to school. The point is that all of us have to make sacrifice. And we relate to that sacrifice. We know how we're committed as a result of it. But now notice what the Apostle Paul was willing to sacrifice. Was there any decision on his part when he obeyed the gospel? Sometimes we can read Acts 22 and 16, where Ananias says to Paul, "And now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized, and wash away thy sins." As though all Paul had to do was get up and walk to the baptistry. That's the only decision he had to make. Well, look in chapter 3 of Philippians. Notice what his past was. He says in verse 4, if anyone else thinks to have confidence in the flesh, I more so. He says in verse 5, circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. You see, Paul had great credentials as far as being a Jew was concerned. Maybe his parents had groomed him for one day having a position upon the Sanhedrin. They had put him in the finest schools with the best teachers. And Paul had learned well. But when he obeyed the gospel, he had to turn his back on all that. He had to sacrifice all of that. And sometimes we see that in the lives of people who have to obey the gospel with great sacrifice. For many of us, it's just a matter of obeying the gospel. But for others, it's a matter of maybe turning their backs in effect upon their family and making changes in their life, radical changes. That's exactly what Paul did. For Paul to change from persecuting the church to being a Christian was as radical as if today Yasser Arafat of the PLO was to apply for citizenship in the state of Israel. That's the kind of change that Paul was making when he became a Christian. And because of that willingness to sacrifice, there was a deep commitment on his part. And when we are willing to sacrifice, the commitment will be the same. But why change? Why make such a sacrifice? Why go to all the trouble? I would suggest that secondly, it was because Paul, as he says in this very verse, was seeking to gain Christ. Notice in the verses that surround this one, that Paul talks about his relationship with Christ. He counted all things as lost for Christ, verse 7. In this verse, he talks about doing that for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus. At the end of the verse, he says he wants to gain Christ. In verse 9, he says, I want to be found in him. In verse 10, that I may know him. And at the end of that verse, that I may have fellowship in his suffering. When you think about the Apostle Paul, you think about the closeness of his relationship to Christ. You know, often we talk about brethren, and maybe the name of a couple is mentioned, and we say, well, you know, where do they go to church? And we associate different brethren with certain churches, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when we think of the Apostle Paul, we think of a close relationship that he has with Christ. And that's something all of us are seeking to find if we're Christians. And sometimes it's hard for us to appreciate the worth and the value of what that relationship means. You know, during the last couple of years that we lived in England, we had a chance on one occasion, Levon and I, to go over to Paris. And my folks were visiting. We had them keep the kids. We went over to Paris to make a 48-hour sort of see-all-you-can tour. And one of the first places we went to there was the Louvre, a sort of a museum that has both art pieces and artifacts from the past. And one of the things we knew that was in that museum was the Mona Lisa. And so as we got into the museum, we were looking through various rooms, and we had a little guide, and so we slowly made our way to the room where this Mona Lisa was. Why, we'd heard of it all our lives, and what a great work of art that it was. And sure enough, when we turned the corner to the designated room, there was a big group of people around a little painting over on one side. We went up and looked at the painting and probably spent all of 3 minutes, maybe four, looking at that. And then went on. Now, that painting was a beautiful picture, and a lot of people might spend a lot more time looking at it, but the problem was we didn't have an appreciation for art like others would, who would maybe sit for an hour or two and look at every detail of that painting. And the problem with a lot of people is they have no appreciation for the value of what Christ has done for them. They'll spend the same amount of time listening to what the gospel has to say. That's all it means to them. If we're not careful, the same thing can happen to us. For those of us who were here last Sunday afternoon, I think we were all stirred by the thoughts that Brother Hill Roberts brought to us concerning just what it meant for Christ to be crucified. If we could hear maybe a tape of that lesson before we partook of the Lord's Supper, I don't think we'd have any problems focusing our attention upon what that means. Sometimes it's difficult for us to appreciate the worth and the value of the gospel. That's why Paul says in chapter 1 of Philippians, verse 27, only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ. There's a certain standard that the gospel suggests to which we have to live. Well, this was the level of commitment demonstrated by Paul. Now let's look at some principles then concerning that commitment and the joy that he expresses as far as the gospel is concerned. First of all, I would suggest that as far as these principles, commitment to Christ, if we have that commitment, is going to breed commitment to our brethren. As Paul became more committed to Christ, he couldn't help but have a closer attachment and feeling and mutual respect for the Philippian brethren. And I think that's evident throughout the epistle as we read. But I want to look particularly at one section that I think especially illustrates that feeling of devotion that he has for them. Over in chapter 2, verses 25 to 30, Paul is writing to the Philippians concerning the messenger that they sent, a man by the name of Epaphroditus. The Philippian brethren, being concerned for Paul, had sent Epaphroditus to Rome. Epaphroditus had become sick, and now Paul was sending him back. Let's just read those verses. Verse 25, he says, "Yet I considered it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker and fellow soldier, but your messenger and the one minister to my need, since he was longing for you all and was distressed because you had heard that he was sick. For indeed he was sick almost unto death. But God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore I send him the more eagerly, and when you see him again, you may rejoice, and I may be less sorrowful. Receive him therefore in the Lord with all gladness, and hold such men in esteem, because for the work of Christ he came close to death, not regarding his life, to supply what was lacking in your service toward me." I would suggest that if we look closely at what's happening there, we can see the kind of concern that Paul had for his brethren and that they had for him. Notice, first of all, that he talks about these Philippian brethren and the concern that they have for him. They had sent Epaphroditus to Paul in Rome because they could not all come themselves. He was their messenger. But notice also that they have a concern for Epaphroditus. They had found out that he was sick. And Paul says, apparently, this is causing you great distress. Isn't that how we feel often when we know someone and then we hear that suddenly they're very, very ill? And we become concerned for their welfare. That's exactly what had happened with the Philippians concerning Epaphroditus. But notice then what Paul's attitude in this matter was. He says, I'm going to send Epaphroditus back because not only have I been distressed about his condition, but I know that you are distressed for him. So rather than keep him here with me and enjoy his fellowship and companionship, I'm going to send him back to you because I know that that will be of comfort to you. That was a sacrifice on his part. In the same way, Paul speaks of God having mercy on Epaphroditus, that he was not sick unto death, that he recovers from this sickness. And he says that the Lord was actually having mercy not only on Epaphroditus, but on the Apostle Paul as well. But then notice thirdly, in reference to this triangle of emotions, that we find that Epaphroditus himself was exercising a great care and longing for both of these parties. The very reason that he had hazarded his life and gone to Rome was because of his concern for his fellow Christian Paul. And by the same token, he had a great longing for the Philippian brethren because they had heard that he was sick, they were distressed, and so he was concerned for them. Have you ever seen that happen? Somebody is taken ill, and somebody else becomes concerned, and that person gets better, and then they want the other party to know that they're better. That's exactly the situation we have here. And so, in fact, what you have is this triangle of emotions where each party is showing a concern for the other. all of them concerned for the welfare of each other. Now, why was that the case? Why were they so concerned and involved with each other? It was because they had a concern for Christ. Notice that if Christ was not in the picture, that concern would not exist. That all of this grows from their commitment and their dedication to Christ. Now, I think there's a lesson there for us. If we want to become concerned more for each other, then what we need to do is work in reference to our concern for Christ, and from that will grow our concern and commitment to each other. But notice, secondly, that this commitment to each other grows out of the gospel. A lot of times when we're thinking about our relationships with each other, we recognize that maybe we don't spend enough time with each other in the way of just social fellowship. And we try and encourage that as individuals. We do all that we can to spend more time with each other. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's instrumental in us getting to know each other better. But I would suggest that the example that we have here in Philippians is not necessarily that these people spent so much time together in social fellowship, but they spent their time together partaking in and having fellowship in the gospel. That is why the Philippians had such a great concern for Paul. Over in chapter 4, in verse 10, Paul says, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity." Here is the care of the Philippian brethren toward Paul. What does that grow out of? Look back in chapter 1 and verse 5. He says, "Because of your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now." Our concern for other brethren arises because we participate with them in the gospel. We have a list over here of men that we support. Many of these men have been here and spoken, and we've come to know them better. Our concern for what they are doing doesn't grow out of merely the fact that they're over in a difficult place, but they're trying to accomplish something in which we have a part. That is the spreading of the gospel. And so that becomes a concern of ours. As I mentioned about last weekend, what a wonderful weekend. Now, why was that so wonderful? Was it simply because we met some Christians from Alabama who were good teachers? Or that we spent a lot of time together in Bible study? Or was the value that we were sharing with these other Christians in looking at the great glory of God's creation? And we come to appreciate them more because we're sharing in doing the thing that we all have a vested interest in, that is, serving God. And so most importantly, I would suggest, in reference to our commitment to each other, is that we share in the things of the gospel. And from that, there grow out other blessings. But then let's move finally to the last aspect that we want to address, and that is this matter of joy. We've talked about commitment, what that commitment leads to, what it grows from in terms of our activity. But what about this element of joy? I would suggest that joy is something that grows out of commitment more so than commitment growing out of joy. In other words, it's not just a matter of feeling good or doing something that makes us feel good that's going to cause our commitment to be what it should be. Rather, that commitment focuses attention upon Christ and what He is. And then when we become absorbed in doing all that God wants us to do, and our attention is focused upon being the kind of Christian that we know God wants us to be, from that, almost as a side effect, will come this joy and contentment that so many people are trying to find. In other words, we can't just create the joy without the commitment. Now notice in those statements we looked at earlier, and I would suggest that in each of those cases, this is true. Look at Philippians 1 and verse 4. Paul says, "Always in every prayer of mine, making requests for you all with joy, for your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now." Paul says, "I can pray to God for you and be joyful about that." Why? Because of this concern that they each share in spreading the gospel to others. In chapter 1 and verse 18, again, Paul talks about rejoicing. He says, "What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice. Now the context there is that Paul is saying, I'm in prison, others are preaching, not because they want to preach, but because they want to raise affliction for me. Paul says, even though that's true, I can rejoice in that because the gospel is being spread. And then over in chapter 2 in verses 17 and 18, notice the background here. Paul says, yes, and if I am being poured out as a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. For the same reason, you also be glad and rejoice with me. Now, how can there be this joy and affection for one another? Paul says, I'm at the point of being poured out, put to death for you. But he says, as long as I can know that you're being faithful and doing everything that you can, that makes me joyful, regardless of what's going on, regardless of whether my life is taken or not. I can rejoice. Over in chapter 4 and verse 10, he rejoices that they have seen to his needs. We read the verse a moment ago. He says, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. That sounds a little bit selfish, doesn't it? Paul is getting something from the Philippians, so he says, yes, it's great. Keep sending it. But notice what he says down in verse 17. He says, not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that abounds to your account. Why do I rejoice? Because I know that you are spiritually progressing and maturing as a result of it. Then in chapter 4 and verse 1, again, he says, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy and crown. They are his joy because of their faithfulness and effectiveness as far as the gospel is concerned. And then the principle in chapter 4 and verse 4, notice what he says, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I will say rejoice. Now, I think there is certainly a sense in which we ought to be content with what we have all the time, that regardless of the circumstances, that we can have an inner contentment where we know that God is going to take care of us. But sometimes things don't go like we plan, and things aren't just what we would like them to be. And yet Paul says we can rejoice. Why? Because of our relationship with the Lord. As long as that's right, everything else will take care of itself. Think of Paul in that cold prison cell. Here he was suffering, not knowing his faith. You take away the gospel from that man, and you take away his joy. You cut his heart out. Because if there's no gospel, if there's no Savior who's died for him, then everything he's doing and trying to accomplish is for naught. But with that gospel there is that joy, that contentment, knowing that despite the fact that he's suffering, that things aren't going right, that he can rejoice. I would suggest that joy grows out of that commitment that we have to the Lord. Someone has said that being happy, being joyful, is not just going around all the time taking our emotional pulse, asking ourselves, am I happy? Am I fulfilled? And we seem to be a society obsessed with questions like those. Let me ask you, was Paul in that prison cell asking himself, now, I wonder how fulfilling this all is to me? That was not his concern. His concern was a commitment to accomplishing what the Lord had for him. I sometimes walk into the religious bookstores, or have frequently in the recent past, and it seems to me like there's almost a proliferation of books designed to help you with every detail, every problem that you'll ever encounter in life. As though, if you get all those books and read them, your life will just be sorted out and you'll have no problem. The gospel does not promise us that. There are going to be difficulties. But what our commitment to Christ does is allow us to face those head on, whatever our circumstances be, and we can rejoice because we know that the Lord's will is being accomplished. Do you share in that kind of a joy this morning? Is it a joy that comes from this commitment and dedication to what God wants us to do? I would suggest that the more we become dedicated to Christ, that we seek to gain Christ, that our joy will grow. But maybe you're like the Ethiopian eunuch. Maybe you don't know what the Bible is talking about, what it means. You can share in the joy that that man experienced by studying and reading from the Scriptures. Maybe you're here this morning and you're not a Christian. You don't even know what God's plan is for you. If that's the case, let me suggest that you either ask someone's help or you start reading from the New Testament to find out what you must do in order to become committed to Christ. Maybe you're a Christian here, and like the young man I described, your heart is not in everything that you're doing. If that's because of some kind of a public sin that you have committed, and that stands in your way from being fulfilled as a Christian and doing all that you know to be, then you have an opportunity this morning, right now, to make that right. All the brethren here would be willing to pray to God and ask for His forgiveness for you, helping you in any way that we can. If you're subject to the invitation in any way, we invite you to come as we stand together and sing the song of invitation.